Welcome to the Snowfighters Institute podcast, coming from some of the most interesting people in the professional snow and ice management industry. To learn about their successes, to hear about the challenges they've faced along the way, and to have their perspective on critical issues facing our industry today. Before we get started, I'd like to invite you to follow our social media feeds and to check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com. Please welcome your host, Phil Harwood.
All right, everyone. Well, I am very excited to have with us as our special guest, Levi Jett. Levi is the CEO of Jett Facility Consultants. He's the author of the book titled Preparing the Snowfighter, A Guide to SnowCon and the MSTS. I can't wait to hear about what those things mean. Available on Amazon. And he's a retired military veteran. Thanks for being here, Levi.
Thank you, Phil, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm really excited to hear your story and just hear what you have going on with your consulting business and about this book that you wrote and all this stuff. So let's kind of start at the beginning. I always like to start these podcast interviews about just like telling us who you are. Like, where did you grow up? Where did you come from? How did you end up, you know, serving in the military? And maybe that just kind of walk us into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Indiana, born and raised. My dad was a welder, and he's still a welder, actually. You know, mom did work in cafeterias through most of her life. And, you know, they were very safe people. You know, they didn't often take risks, and which, you know, has kind of led me, I think, to take more risks than I normally would have. But I went into the military. Really what inspired me to do that was 9/11. You know, I was in eighth grade when 9/11 happened. And I think a lot of people, you know, around my age group probably made that decision because of that. So I joined the Army, served 9 years, and am a combat disabled veteran from Operation Enduring Freedom, which was the war in Afghanistan. Oh, wow. And I was a military police officer. I served in Afghanistan from 2009 through 2010, and my Army career spanned from 2006 through 2015.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, first of all, just God bless you and thank you for your service. Amazing.
My pleasure.
Yeah. When you, so yeah, 9/11, I mean, changed the world. In eighth grade, you know, you're very impressionable. You're thinking about what kind of person you want to be. I know you're not probably thinking about college at that point in your life, but you're thinking about your future and you're affected by things around, you're aware of what's happening around you. Did you, then get into like ROTC and stuff like that? Or did you play sports or what, or did you help your dad with welding or what were you into, like, you know, before you joined the Army?
Yeah. So I played football. I was in the JROTC program in high school. Funny story. So, you know, shortly, I would say, you know, a few months after 9/11, again, you know, I made it up in my head, hey, you know, this is what I want to do. And I remember telling my dad, you know, about it and talked him into taking me to a recruiter. And in his head, you know, he was just thinking, oh, you know, he wants to, you know, get some information, you know, kind of learn a few things. In my head, I was wanting to enlist, you know, in the eighth grade. Yeah. So we went to this recruiter and, you know, I've always, you know, I'm 6'2". I've always been taller for my age. And so went in there and the recruiter thought, you know, I was a legitimate, you know, 17, 18 year old recruit. Oh, wow. With my parent there.
Yeah.
You know, so he's sitting there, you know, telling about benefits and, you know, just running through the whole spiel and has me fill out a contact sheet. And so it's funny because, you know, I'm sitting there, I remember looking at the contact sheet, you know, and them wanting to know information that I just don't know as an eighth grader, like my social security number.
Yeah, because you're probably like 13
stuff like
or 14
that.
Years old, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but, you know, I filled it out the best I could and, you know, handed it back to the recruiter. And, you know, he takes a quick look at it and he goes, wait a minute, but you were born in 88? I go, yeah. And he goes, how old are you? And I was like, 13. And he just, you know, crumbles the paper up, throws it away and goes, hey, kid, if you're this excited about it in a few years, come back and see.
Yeah, right, right. So it sounds like your parents were supportive, though.
Very much, yeah. Mom, you know, was a typical mom, and she didn't want me to enlist. I don't think either parent really did, especially, you know, enlisting during a time of war, I think, mm-hmm. is a different mindset than enlisting sure. in a time of peace.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I can't even imagine what you saw over there and the kind of experiences did you have that you had. But was there anything from that kind of, before we move on in our conversation, was there anything that you wanted to kind of share from your experience about that?
About so, military days? I mean, I guess one of the biggest takeaways for me was just, you know, in America, we're so involved in so many little things, you know, I think petty is the word, right? You know, just, you know, little minuscule things that happen from day to day that really have no impact on anything. But as a society, we seem to just be, you know, engulfed in, you know, wanting to focus on the small things. And being in a country where, you know, the drive to work, you could encounter a roadside bomb, or, you know, at your place of business, you know, you could have a terrorist attack. While you're at work, you know, terrorists could come kidnap your family. And knowing that that's what those people go through every day, and that's what they have to think about, you know, really put a perspective on, you know, how we live life over here and what's really important.
Yeah, it's so true. We're so insulated, you know, and that's what really has, I think, changed the generation that we're in now from compared to, you know, just the evolution of generations, going back to the greatest generation, right, that fought in wars and their fathers fought in wars and their grandfathers fought in wars. And, you know, we're spoiled and we're insulated and you're right, we have the luxury to complain about, you know, the taste of our food or how cold our beer is, or, you know what I mean? We argue about politics and everything, right? We're a classic divided society right now. But we have the luxury to do that because we're not facing all those other existential threats every day, like you just described. And,
absolutely.
So yeah, that's a great observation. Not that I wish we were all involved in wars, and, you know, I never had to serve and never was able to, never felt compelled to sign up and serve. But, you know, my parents, I mean, my dad and my uncles and my grandfather, they all did their time, you know, even if they didn't serve in combat, you know, they had to go serve. So yeah, we're missing out. And I think some of the countries that have mandatory service, you know, really, I think there's really something beneficial, and I almost feel like we should go back to that, but that's for a conversation for another day. How did you then
sure.
transition from that experience? So what, you came back, you're done, you're moving on to something else. How did you end up in the snow industry?
So leaving the military, you know, a lot of soldiers come away with, you know, mental health issues, and I was definitely one of those. Coming back, you know, I faced crippling depression and anxiety, and it really, you know, took ill on my professional career and what I wanted to do. And so, you know, coming back, you know, I had a lot of experience, not experience, but I got the opportunities to work at a bunch of different places, and, you know, from restaurant to retail warehousing, forklift jobs, security, call centers, even plumbing. And it was just trying to find somewhere where I felt that I fit. And it was really hard to do. But getting that mixed bag of experience made me have a greater appreciation for when good opportunities would come around.
Sure.
So just before getting into the industry, I was at, the lowest point, in my life up to that point. Again, just battling day in and day out with mental health issues. Again, not having a, any kind of career to speak of. It was really just, scraping and getting by, and not even, scraping working, a decent job. It was really, scraping to, get anything, doing Uber Eats and DoorDash and, donating plasma and stuff like that just to, have money through the week to be able to put in the gas tank to get to work.
That's tough.
And so, I was looking on Craigslist as I often did for, quick paying jobs, places that were hiring immediately. And I saw a job posting and it said field supervisor, snow operations. And I thought to myself, what the heck is this? It's August, And so I clicked
It's
on
not
it
snowing in
and
August.
And there's a lot of spam on Craigslist. So a lot of the jobs that seem maybe too good to be true usually are. And so I'm reading through this post, all the information, and I go, wow, like this really sounds like, something I'd be interested in. And, I put in an application knowing all well, it's probably, spam of some sort. Very next day, human resources from Case reaches out and we do a phone interview. And the very next day after that, I have a second phone interview with their operations department.
This is Case Snow Management up in
And
Massachusetts.
right out of Attleboro. And, the job didn't start until late October, but it was something that I felt it was worth pursuing no matter how I could get there. But, at the time it was like, how am I going to get from mid-August to late October? Like what am I going to do to piece, piece in paychecks and then things to be able to make it? Because, I was telling myself, I don't want to start a job somewhere else and, have to walk away from it in just a
All
few
right.
months. So, against the better judgment of, my circle of people, my friends and family, I took the job with Case and I went out to Massachusetts. They invite all of their seasonal field supervisors to Massachusetts for a training weekend. And I remember, my mom, who was always a worrier, her biggest concern about this was that the plane ticket that they'd given me was fake. And,
She thought it was too good to be true.
And, I kept telling him, like, hey, it's an airport. Like, you're not going to make it very far with a fake plane ticket. You won't even get past security. And I think in her head, she was imagining that I'd be on the flight and the flight attendant would come around and be like, oh, you have a fake ticket, and just throw me off the plane at 30,000 feet. I got to the Case headquarters there in Attleboro and, seeing the facility, getting to meet some of the people. I decided at that time, I wanted to try to change the outcome of my life and really of my career. And so I decided then and there to do something that I don't normally do. And it was really three different things. So one of those was I put myself in front of decision makers more often. I was the type of person that would always kind of, stand back in the shadows a little bit. And, expect people to seek me out. And So I put myself in front of, my boss. I made sure that it was important to me that, he shook my hand, that he saw my face. And then, I went to his boss. I did the same thing. And then, went to Jason Case and made sure that at the end of that weekend, Jason knew who I was and, knew that, I was there to do whatever I could to help him and to help that company.
Great move.
And so the next thing I did was I put 100% of myself into that job, which, I was refusing to do up to that point. I did everything that I could every day that I woke up. That was a case day. It was, how, what am I going to do to, again, to help the company? What do they need me to do today? I didn't have much of a social life to speak of. It was just case, just focused on case. And then really the last thing, which kind of goes hand in hand, is, I worked desperate. I never said no. Anything they needed me to do was a yes. It didn't matter, where they were asking me to travel to, what they were asking me to do once I got there. Everything was a yes. And really, doing those things put me in a really good light with that company and, provided me a ton of opportunity after that first winter season.
So were those kind of strategies that you learned in the military, or did you read about those, or how did you kind of have those things in your mind?
So really, it was kind of just coming to just thinking about life and thinking about decisions I've made that got me where I am. And the episode of Seinfeld where George does the opposite of everything he's ever done. It was kind of that sort of thinking where, okay, if I'm often in the shadows expecting someone to seek me out, what's the opposite of that? Okay, well, put myself in front of those people to where they can't avoid me, and they actually see me. Okay, if I wasn't, working like I really cared before, what's the opposite of that? And to some extent, I took it too far, because it started to affect a work-life balance later on in life, and that I wasn't really aware that it was really affecting that because that was the way that I worked. So it was hard to, kind of pull the reins back to find a healthy work-life balance eventually.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that those things kind of came from your own introspection and just your own mind. Because then, I mean, that's way more meaningful to you because they really came from yourself. They were from your own reflection on your life. And I do think those are good, really good things to focus on for someone new in a job. Like, really, really invest yourself, really put in the extra effort, really be devoted. And maybe, yeah, to an unhealthy level. But then, once you're into the job and you have a good handle on it, then you can pull back a little bit, and then you have to get that work-life balance. But there's something to be said for, especially in the beginning, for 6 months, first year, like, really make that your priority, even if some other things
Exactly.
kind of sit on the back burner, just to plant yourself and be in a good place, and then you can make some adjustments from there. So then, where'd you go from there? So how'd that first winter go?
So that first winter, again, it was a lot of opportunity, a lot of experience gained. So that first winter, there was a really bad storm in North Carolina, and one of Case's clients, asked, "Hey, can you guys basically come down here to save the day?" And I was part of that deployment that went to North Carolina, and it was really good for my field career because I got about a week spent with guys from the East Coast that knew how to plow snow, that knew what the best practices were and knew what the expectations were. And without that, I just don't think that I would have been had the same skill level in a plow truck that I was able to develop. So that's, you know, one of the biggest points from that first year, was just, you know, getting the experience and the exposure with, you know, guys from the East Coast. I've always said, you know, that snow removal is everywhere, but in places where, again, it snows a lot, it's more of a science. It's very methodical, in the approach of, you know, how it's removed, and then also what the customer expectations are. Because when your customer and your provider is very methodical and, you know, knows exactly what they're doing, your expectation of that soars. Yeah. And I just don't think in some other parts of the country, we're there yet with the level of snow removal.
Yeah, what a great opportunity. And, you know, being in an emergency scenario, coming in to save the day, that's always exciting too. Everyone's energy is pumped up. Everyone's got their game on. Everyone wants to be the hero. And, you know, you said North Carolina. Some people on this call might be thinking, does it even snow in North Carolina? And I got to tell you, I've been in snowstorms in North Carolina. It absolutely snows in North Carolina.
Yes.
Especially up in the mountains.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to the book, and I want to also hear about your consulting business. So kind of take us from there to bridge the gap between that experience to what you're doing now. And where did the book come into all this?
Yeah. So, you know, I continued my career with Case and, you know, continued to climb the ranks there, and really just continued to learn not only the field portion of the job, but that back office portion of the job too. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I, you know, have taken from the military and applied to really every point of my life is, you know, just assessing, you know, what's really going on. And, you know, sometimes the best way to fix something or to become aware of an issue is by, you know, taking yourself out of the situation some and just, you know, getting different views and different perspectives on something. So, you know, as I continue my career at Case, you know, one of the things that I realized was, you know, it's really hard to prepare for something that you can't recreate. You know, we can't order 4 inches of snow over a certain area, right? You know, even in winter, you know, it's just, it is what it is. You get what you get. And when it's in winter, you know, you have to be on. There is little time for actual training and, you know, really learning and teaching opportunities. So
yeah, people say, well, let's, you know, go out and do a dry run. Well, there's no snow on the ground. All you're doing is driving around.
Sure.
You're just finding the property, but it's not the same as plowing snow and having an event with a clock ticking.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I eventually got to a senior account manager at Case, and during that time, the team that I had working for me, they had no snow experience and they had no exterior services experience. And I go, man, you know, walking into this winter, you know, might be brutal if I cannot figure out a way to, you know, somehow show them what a snowstorm is going to be like. Because, you know, if you never served with a snow company during a snowstorm, you know, it's just very hard to replicate. So, you know, I started thinking. And one of the things that I learned in the military, so both Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan and Operation Iraqi Freedom in Iraq are kind of covered under the same designation of the Global War on Terror. So when those two conflicts started, not very long into it, the military realized, hey, we've got two major issues. One is that our vehicles do not have the armor. They're not equipped with the armor to sustain these roadside bombs
I
and
remember
these
reading
IEDs
about
and these
that, yeah.
vehicle-borne IEDs. Yeah. And, you know, we're sustaining massive casualties because of that. And almost just as important is we are also sustaining heavy casualties when we go into building clearing or room clearing. It's just something that, you know, we're not training on. And that's something more reserved for, you know, SWAT team or special forces or, you know, things like that. And so they created the Military Operations and Urban Terrain, or commonly referred to as MOUT. And so that was really, you know, the training they developed on, okay, this is how, you know, you move down a city street if you're on a foot patrol. You know, this is how you're going to, you know, enter a house, and this is how you need to clear each room and maneuver as a team. And in doing that and, you know, spreading that training around, it started to reduce that casualty rate, because at one point, you know, the mortality rate of that first guy into the room was like 70 or 75%.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, a horrible number. But incorporating this, you know, this mount really helped, you know, drive those numbers back down. Obviously still a very dangerous experience, but with the proper training, you know, it takes some of the risk out of it. And so they started to create, you know, these mount training facilities. Well, when you're on a base with, you know, 20 or 30,000 other soldiers, it's not always your day to have that training facility. And so you have to get creative with, okay, if we can't use this range every day, how are we going to continue to develop these skills? And more importantly, what are the skills within this that we really need to develop? Is it, you know, testing your response time from, you know, being able to pull up your weapon if someone is standing in front of you? Or, you know, is it, you know, how to actually maneuver through the house and how to actually enter the house?
Okay.
So that kind of spawned the term glass house. And so this was, you know, kind of a, you know, poor man's training of, you know, a mount facility where you would, you know, take whatever's around, sticks, pieces of wood. If you were, you know, in an area with sand or some loose dirt, you take your boot and, you know, you would draw out lines to represent a floor plan. And so once you built this floor plan, then you would have teams practice taking turns working through it. Looking at it, you know, from the outside in, you would think they're crazy people, you know, because what are you talking about? You're, you know, if there's a person in the house, I can see them right there. You know, and I can also look down and I can see where all these rooms are, you know, and in your head, sometimes you think that it's kind of stupid. But what it did was it worked on your technique and the details and the muscle memory of, you know, how you actually maneuver through the house. One of the things is, you know, when you're going to enter, you know, you can't just line up and shout, all right, guys, we're going on three, because everybody in the house or the building hears you too. So they know exactly when you're coming in.
Sure.
So, you know, that has to be nonverbal cues.
Yes.
And so with a glass house, you develop those. You know, each person in that fire team has a designated zone in each room that they're responsible for. Each person that enters the room goes a different way. And it's just practicing that. And then once a room is clear and you move on to the next one, again, you know, you stack up on another wall and do the same thing over again. And those are the details and the techniques that are, you know, really difference makers. So I'm thinking, okay, glass house, could I create a glass storm or a mock storm where we tried to recreate as much as we can, minus the snow, to be able to really walk through and talk through scenarios and, you know, raise the confidence level, you know, of my team going into winter.
Well, it totally makes sense because, you know, we all know, you know, just sitting, doing, you know, training in a classroom or a lecture hall or a whatever, you know, just it's intellectual, it's in your head, and you can kind of think it through in your mind, but your body's not moving. You're not actually physically doing anything. And like you and I play sports, you know, think about all the muscle memory that you gain from just practicing every day, making those maneuvers, depending on what sport you played, what position you played, doing it over and over and over again. You know, think how many times a pro golfer swings a golf club, you know, on the practice range, thousands or tens of thousands of times. How many times, you know, a pro quarterback throws a pass for practicing. So they're not sitting in a classroom just thinking, oh yeah, I understand how to maneuver my arm and I can see it in my mind, but I never try it physically with my own effort. Totally different. And then to do it over and over again, where you're actually getting that muscle memory and doing it. And I learned this when I very first started doing public speaking, that I had to say things out loud. The words had to come out of my mouth. And I used to sometimes trip over words, and I would say them 100 times before it just flowed out. And then when I was actually on stage or doing a podcast or something, I could actually get the words out of my mouth. But if I would have just sat there in my mind and rolled through it in my head, it would have been totally different. So what you're saying here absolutely makes sense.
Yeah.
So I love where you're going, you know, with this.
Sure. So it's a, you know, once we came up with the mock storm training system, you know, we were able to then say, okay, how are we going to, you know, best implement this? And, you know, again, I was working at Case. We also had a, you know, full-time landscaping too at this point. So, you know, my snow team is my landscaping team. And so it's hard for me to say, all right, guys, we're going to take, you know, 4 hours out of today and, you know, just spend on this pretend snowstorm, when we have, you know, real live clients and, you know, issues to deal with the landscaping. So the first one we did, you know, I sent an email on Sunday night to my team, and it was a weather email, you know, saying, hey, from the National Weather Service in Chicago, you know, a winter storm watch or warning has been, you know, issued for, you know, Cook and Lake counties. And, you know, I went through and, you know, listed, you know, what's going to happen during the storm, what's the forecast. Underneath that, then I listed, you know, certain controls. So the great thing about the mock storm training system is that, you know, whether you are a sub-supplier model or a self-performing model, or even a mix of both, it can be, you know, shifted how it needs to best suit your model. And so, you know, within that mock storm, there are controls and considerations that you need to make. So one of those controls is procurement. You know, what's the timing of this storm? Is this going to be a December 1st event, you know, where maybe, you know, your procurement's at 75% because it's still somewhat kind of early. Mm-hmm. Or is this going to be a late January event where ideally you should be 100% procured by then?
You would hope.
Again, you know, take into consideration your staffing levels, the quality of your employees, the reliability of the employees. And it's important to be honest. You know, everyone doesn't have a group of A+ 10 out of 10 employees. You know, on a team of 10 employees, you might be lucky to have a couple that you would consider, you know, 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10. You know, you're going to have some eights and some sevens, and, you know, even some sixes in there. And so, you know, how do they all play together during an event? You know, consider your equipment, your customers. Who are your customers that before the first flake even falls in their head, you know, you're already in event and they're already wanting answers and wanting this, you know, over correspondence to happen to make them feel better. You know, factor that in. Equipment, you know, maybe you have a couple loaders go down before an event. You know, how is that team going to fix that to where those sites are still serviced? And so these are all, you know, different controls and considerations that can be adjusted. So, you know, that Sunday night email, okay, hey, you know, we're at 85% procurement. So we have some work to do, whether it's procuring these sites or finding emergency time and material for these sites. Or, you know, maybe we have some case trucks in the area and now we can, you know, push those case trucks to say, hey, we're going to self-perform this group of sites right here. You know, again, staffing levels, you know, okay, so, hey, you know, this account manager over this region came down with COVID. So, you know, they're not going to, I mean, they're not just positive, they're sick. So they're not going to be in the storm at all, you know, and hey, you know, two of our shovelers, they quit, they found other jobs, you know, or maybe it's our best operator, you know, went to a competitor, or again, you know,
real life things that
is out sick, or
yeah,
exactly.
I love, you know, this, and it's so it's scenario planning, it's just, but it's not just theoretical. Like you're actually role playing it out.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, because these are the things that you have to figure out how to overcome during a storm. And this is the details you need to make sure that are right. And again, muscle memory in your head. Hey, I know that if, you know, I have, you know, this person show up late because they normally do, you know, I know what I need to do before that. Mm-hmm. Or this person, you know, wants to work snow, but somehow always calls in a snowstorm, you know, now I can kind of prepare for that in my head, you know, months before winter. And I can be real with myself about where I am with my snow team. And maybe, you know, some things that I need to adjust or fix before then. And then something else that ends up being really great is this creates the ability for you to have a lean snow team. Because you can play let's pretend, and maybe, you know, you've often wondered, hey, what would happen if, you know, account manager A actually led the storm from a senior operations role? Could they do it? Mm-hmm. Well, hey, you know, find out.
Right. See what happens.
You know, or yeah, you know, and because if it's a huge disaster, okay, yeah, you know, you killed a few hours, but you know, you didn't lose any customers. No one went without service, and it wasn't that big of a deal at the end of the day because it happened in July.
Yeah. So Levi, just, and I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but does your book then kind of walk through this process of this mock storm? And is that what SnowCon is?
So the mock storm is the MSTS portion of that title. And so it really kind of, you know, breaks down again, you know, more things to consider, controls, kind of walks you through, you know, how to do this yourself. And then SnowCon is another system entirely, and it's also influenced very largely from the military. So the military has DEFCON, which is the mm-hmm. defense readiness condition. Mm-hmm. And this is SnowCon, which is essentially the snow readiness condition.
I see. Okay.
And so SnowCon is going to vary between levels of intensity of a storm. So for instance, say there's a, you know, 4 to 6 inch event coming through, that's going to fall as a SnowCon 3. And a SnowCon 3, you know, that's going once the company moves to a SnowCon 3, that's going to unleash a complex chain of events, but it's going to coordinate the efforts from the very beginning. So you're going to have a high level SnowCon chart that's going to show, you know, your operational leaders, you know, not only what needs to happen, but what their teams are doing. And then for each specific team, so again, just throwing a few out there, say you have a field team, say you have an account management team, and then say you have a fleet team, you know, each of those are going to have their own individual SnowCon with their own individual tasks of what they need to do to prepare for a storm of this magnitude.
Got it.
And so it really centralizes the efforts going into the event, and it takes decision-making out of the way, which is, you know, something where, again, you want it to be more autonomous, and you don't want people necessarily making a bunch of decisions in a very high stress environment. You want those decisions to be made.
Response plan on steroids.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, you want those decisions to be made when there's no snow on the ground and they have all the time in the world to make a really good decision. And you put those in place. And so, and again, you know, you can use this for the entire winter. I've sent daily SnowCon updates to customers before. And what that does for your customer is it really shows, hey, these guys are on top of it. They're always watching the weather, and because their system depends on it. And not only that, but their readiness is always high, because if you're following this chart, then again, you know, that takes care of your readiness. And that's a big selling point to customers.
Yeah. I was going to say, obviously this is a big operational tool here, but I would think this would be really powerful in a sales scenario too, because this is something unique. And, you know, like I said, I think to me, it sounds like a snow response plan, but at a very high level and probably more detailed than what most people would do with their snow response planning and their scenario planning. If people are even doing that.
And both of them together, they honestly kind of work like a playbook. So, you know, once you get into winter, again, if you're working with people that don't have years of snow experience, you know, this gives them a tool to use actually in events where maybe a situation pops up and they don't know what to do, but they remember that a similar situation happened during a mock storm. If they took notes and had that, they could flip and say, okay, this is a situation. Here's what we did. Let's try this now.
Yeah. And then how does this relate to your consulting business? You know, jet facility consultants, are you working with service providers, contractors? Are you working with facility managers, or is it a mix, or kind of what all does your consulting entail?
Yeah. So jet facility consultants, we're really trying to, our main customer is service provider, whether it's small or massive, it could be a management company. Those are the people we're going after. And so our two biggest things right now is the mock storm training system and SnowCon, which is where, you know, we come out and, you know, we run the staff through a mock storm where we help you implement the SnowCon for you to use. We also do, you know, one-on-one operational coaching. We do operational team coaching as well. And, you know, really, you know, I want to share what I've learned and what I'm learning the more that I observe the industry. The processes that, you know, we have here at Jet Facility Consultants, I believe will help nearly any snow vendor that's out there. And I believe our programs, you know, they increase the confidence and the readiness of the snow team. And like you said, you know, it operations and sales to me go hand in hand. And so, you know, if your operations is stout and it's ready, it's going to be able to absorb, you know, anything the sales team is able to push down that pipeline.
Mm-hmm. What's the best way for someone to get a hold of you, Levi, if someone on the call here is listening to the podcast, is interested in following up?
Yeah, so a couple different ways. I'm on LinkedIn. Also, jetfacilityconsultants.com. Mm-hmm. There's some more information about pretty much everything that we've discussed today.
Cool.
They're on the website, and there's opportunities to, you know, book appointments with us or, you know, chat with us on the website.
And that's JETT Facility Consultants with an S.com, right?
Yes, sir.
Cool. And the book, if anyone wants to grab a copy of it, is called Preparing the Snow Fighter, A Guide to SnowCon and the MSTS.
Yeah, and I also have a link on my website that you can follow direct to Amazon.
Yeah, awesome. Levi, is there anything we didn't talk about that you were hoping to chat about before we let everyone go?
So
I didn't ask you too much about your personal life, but we did talk about your background a little bit. Are you what do you do when you're not out doing mock storms?
So family time. You know, I've got a wife and two kids.
Nice.
You know, hang out at home a lot. You know, I like watching sports, like taking the kids to their sports.
Cool.
I'm a big fan of smoking meat. Love, you know, working with smoker and, you know, making ribs or pulled pork.
Love it.
Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just, you know,
that's
always trying
like
to make sure.
That's like a whole science in and of itself.
Oh man. Yeah, it is. And, but it's worth it because it's some of the best food that mm-hmm. I've ever made. And yeah. My family, you know, they prefer it if I smoke 5 days a week.
Oh yeah. That's cool. All right. Well, that sounds like fun. And hopefully I'll be able to enjoy some of that someday when I come visit you. Well, Levi, I really appreciate it. Love hearing your story. And I love that you're just out available to serve the industry. And, you know, I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but I will. I'm excited to do that. And again, thank you for your service. And it's just been really great to hear your story and really, really glad we were able to do this.
Awesome, Phil. Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on, and be glad to come back anytime.
All right. Well, we'll talk soon. Thanks, Levi.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Snow Fighters Institute podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, become a subscriber today so you won't miss any future episodes. Don't forget, please check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com.